You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, sunny Davis State. Well, there's some high clouds, but it's still kind of nice. It's going to be over 80, Don.
So they say, partly cloudy right now. This show is going to broadcast on May 1st.
Mayday.
In 2025. As we're recording the show right now, it's 57 degrees. We've been very cool for the last week. We had some rain last Saturday. Boy, that's had a few consequences out in the garden. Wasn't enough to speak of in terms of soil moisture, but yeah, it did some things with respect to fungus. Great fungus weather for the last week. Going up to a high today of 84 degrees. Tonight is going to be 52 degrees and clear. Thursday will be 83 and sunny. Thursday night, 50 degrees and clear. A strange little cooling trend for the weekend again, folks. Friday is going to be 77 and sunny. Friday night, 53 and mostly cloudy. Saturday, 69 degrees with a 20% chance of showers. Saturday, you know, this is funny. I'll just stop right there. I was looking up some notes from last year. This exact thing happened last year. The first week of May, we were 59 degrees on a Saturday and it was raining and our business that day was down about 80%. And then that same week, the end of that week, it was 90 degrees. So it's May in the Sacramento Valley. Saturday night will be 49 degrees and partly cloudy. Sunday will be 74 and mostly sunny. Monday, 77 and sunny. Monday night, 51 and Tuesday, 78. Seven. Key temperature threshold. The soil temperature, according to the Simms weather station with respect to Davis, has hit 60 degrees consistently now for the last couple of days. It had been up and down. That's one of the metrics that we use in terms of when it's time to plant tomatoes. 60 degree soil temperature is what we're looking for tomatoes, not just once, but more or less consistently. And it seems to be there and is staying there. So, hey, guess what, folks?
It's time to plant tomatoes.
There you go. You can also plant beans. And I think it's safe to put in cucumbers and zucchini. I'm not in any rush to get my peppers and eggplants and things in the ground. But with respect to the question that Lois asks every week, starting in mid-January, is it time to plant tomatoes? Go for it. No hurry, but we're finally there with respect to soil temperature. I do want to throw out something real quick. There was an arboretum sale at Davis this last weekend. Four different Davis Garden Show listeners stopped by my nursery to say hi.
Right.
And two of them, I had the presence of mind to write down their names. So April and Tanya, it was great to see you. Always fun when people stop by my nursery and introduce themselves. And to the other two, I'm really sorry I forgot to write down your names, but it was great to see you too. So that was always fun.
And you can send Don messages at davisgardenshow@gmail.com. If you've got questions, comments, just want to chat.
Yeah, and I also had some fun this week. On Monday, I went and spoke to four elementary school classes in a row, which is a long morning. Willett Elementary School, that was great. You folks were lots and lots of fun. If you want to cheer yourself up, go talk to a bunch of six-year-olds about gardening. Let me tell you, here's one thing I'll note. You ask a group of six, 7 or 8 year olds, how many of you are going to have a garden this year? Every one of them raises their hand. Even ones who probably don't have a place outdoors to have a garden. So the first thing I went into was something I think you all should think about. A garden can be as simple as a terrarium in your house. It can be a group of houseplants. It can be one planter that has a basil plant and a flower in it. That's a garden. The garden doesn't have to be a great big thing. And also, if you ever decide to go give a talk to elementary school students, you really don't need to prepare a whole lot. I had about 20 minutes with each class. I spoke for about 5 minutes. And then I just asked if there were any questions. And at that point, it became a free-for-all. And it's very, very entertaining. My grandma's name is Daisy. Cool. Boy in the back. What's the most poisonous plant in the world? Watch that kid. So lots of fun. Always good to see another crop of gardeners coming along. I had a funny conversation with one of the teachers afterwards. It was, where is the age where you go from every kid raising their hand, I'm going to have a garden, to 20% of them raising their hands and saying, I don't know how to garden. I'm not any good at that. I'm not sure what that age of disillusionment is, but I can tell you 6, 7, 8 year olds, they haven't hit it yet. So let's get another crop of gardeners out there. What comment was made at one point that we should talk about some of the problems we're seeing. We will do that. We've also got your questions and all that kind of stuff. But first,
We have announcements.
Yes.
We have so many announcements. I'm just going to do the really quick ones. I mean, the ones that are nearby. First of all, this is May Day. May Day. And the little jingle that I wrote up was because DMA, which is the mothership for
Davis Media Access for KDRT. Yep.
Thank you. Is participating in the Big Day of Giving. And that's affectionately known as Big Dog. Anyway, that's May 1st. Hey, May 1st, isn't that when the show is airing?
Indeed, yes.
If you are listening to this, please go to Davis Media Access /Big Dog and make a donation. We'd really appreciate your help keeping the stations going.
DavisMediaAccess.org/Big Dog. And for those of you outside the area, this is a regional thing. So you're not hearing about this in, you know, Toronto, but you can still donate. You just go to DavisMediaAccess.org/Big Dog.
And if you're listening to the show afterwards and it's not May 1st, don't worry about it. You can still go and donate anytime. DavisMediaAccess/donate.
There you go. We all appreciate your support. And every now and then, the people who receive the donation send us a little note saying, we got one thanking you for the Davis Garden Show. We love the fact there's listeners all over the world, and we really appreciate your support.
We have another announcement. I know Big Day of Giving is for all the nonprofits in the area, but every spring, our station, KDRT, has their annual spring fundraiser. And this is nothing to do with Big Day of Giving. That started a whole lot later. But in this case, we're having a fundraiser special event at Suds and Sounds. So the musical guests are Max and Julian of the Big Poppies, and it'll be held at Armadillo Music in downtown Davis Wednesday, May 7th from 4 to 7 p.m. You are invited to this extra special expanded edition of Suds and Sounds, our monthly meet and greet at Armadillo Music. Come gather with KDRT's dedicated volunteers and friends, grab your beverage of choice, and flip through the bins for some vinyl to spin between live sets from Max and Julian.
There you go. The Big Poppies. That reminds me of something I wanted to mention. This is what we call hyper local. Right now, the most beautiful streets in Davis are L Street and 8th Streets. And I highly recommend that by whatever method of mobility you have, walking, biking, driving, you drive down L Street to see practically an unbroken planting of California poppies, and drive down 8th Street, especially from the corner of 8th and L, to see an amazing display of gazanias and other flowers. That particular group of houses, I wrote an article about them 20 years ago, I think it was. There's the same gardener has been managing two of the homes, and the neighbor further to the west decided to adopt the same strategy, planting gazanias, letting poppies flourish. And I mean, not just California poppies, in this case, Shirley poppies and some of the others, a bunch of other flowers, strategically pulling out seedlings where they come up in the wrong place. And every spring, it is one of the most spectacular displays. And what I like about it, you could do that yourself for less than $20. These are all things that are grown from seed. They're all things that naturalize themselves. There's geraniums that people are taking cuttings and sticking in the ground. It's some of the, there's Dutch iris, if you ever grow, or flag irises, excuse me. If you've ever grown them, you know that that's an over the fence kind of plant, but it's absolutely spectacular. And as you continue down 8th Street, you'll eventually come to the historic Rose Garden planted by Julia Sadler in the 1950s and 60s. The third owner of that house has, like the previous ones, come in to chat with me because they buy the house and they learn, oh my goodness, we apparently have this rose garden everybody knows about. They're maintaining it beautifully. There's roses across the street. So just take a slow sojourn down L and 8th Streets in Davis. If you all know of a better looking street, you go ahead and send that to davisgardenshow@gmail.com. I think we need a front yard competition for the most beautiful gardens in Davis. And if you've got something in another city, well, you know what? Take a picture, send it to us at davisgardenshow@gmail.com. But again, what I really like about this one, anybody can do this. This isn't a fancy high-end landscape that somebody spent a lot of money on. No, they just have a dedicated gardener who knows what she's doing. And you can do that too. Happens that gazanias are great for us, but there's probably a plant that does the same thing wherever you're listening.
So we have a preview of an announcement, and that is hold on to Sunday, May 18th, if you want to go see Patricia's Native Garden late spring ramble. We'll tell you more about that later.
Yeah, Patricia's an ambassador for the Native Plant Society and opens her garden periodically.
So Don, last month in April, which is, you know, today when we're recording this, we didn't do all of the pictures on your calendar. I'm really sorry we didn't get there. But I want people to know that any month you want to, you can go to Don's business site, which is
redwoodbarn.com.
Mm-hmm. And just look for the calendar. And it's beautiful. You can download it if you want to look at it on your computer. You can just amazing photographs that he has taken over the years. Anyway, so we won't worry about the calendar for now. We've still got the month of May to go. We'll do that later. Yeah. But I wanted to talk about some of the things that came into our mailbag. Mm-hmm. And the one that I don't like, but we'll do it anyway, is from Bob in Elk Grove. Mm-hmm. Says, help, I just noticed a large patch of my 20-year-old variegated pittosporum has turned black. Yeah. On closer inspection, I noticed white cottony scale-like insects, photos attached. There were also ants running up and down the branches. As you can see in the photos, the branches are completely turned black. Google Lens identifies this pest as cottony cushion scale. And they were right.
Yes, Google Lens is correct this time.
I blasted the plant with a strong jet of water, which seems to have dislodged some of the scale, but it looks like there's a significant infestation inside the bush. What can you recommend to get rid of this? Would a good pruning to open up the plant be beneficial? I really do not want to lose this bush. Thanks again for your help, knowledge, and insight. Love the show.
Thank you. Cottony cushion scale is a very recognizable scale, although very commonly when someone brings a sample or a picture in, I'll tell them it's an insect and they don't want to believe me because it looks like a massive amount of mold. A cottony cushion scale is covered with a cottony substance, much like mealybugs have. So it sort of looks like a frothy white area. Like all members of that group, all the scale insects, all the white flies, all the aphids, they excrete honeydew, which falls onto the leaves below, and the honeydew settles on the leaves and a black mold grows on that. And that's typically what people notice first, as Bob has done. Cottony cushion scale came into California in the middle of the 20th century and began infesting Meyer lemon orchards, believe it or not, when we had them, and other lemon orchards. So it was primarily known as a citrus pest initially. I've seen it on certain plants, but not others. This is not a completely host-specific pest. That's a term that we use for a pest that only goes after a particular host, but it does seem to have very distinct preferences. Citrus, pittosporum, which is what this particular mock orange is. Remember, mock orange is a common name for more than one plant, but pittosporum or pittosporum, tobira, gets cottony cushion scale. I've also seen it on nandina, which is present in practically every yard in California. And I've seen it on rose bushes. I've seen it on hardenbergia, the lilac vine. So it seems to go to certain plants. Now, people often ask me, how does this thing spread? It obviously doesn't fly. Well, those ants are a big factor. They will carry it from plant to plant. However, in the middle of the 20th century, when it became a threat to citrus orchards, one of the earliest and most successful cases of biological control was management of cottony cushion scale. Researchers went back to where it came from. They found a little ladybird beetle. We call them ladybugs, but ladybird beetle that attacks this particular pest, and they introduced it into California. And rather quickly, it established very, very well. So if you're looking at your large area on one branch of cottony cushion scale, if any of them have holes in them, you already have this biological control agent present. Other things do eat cottony cushion scale, little birds. You'll see them going in there and pecking them off, for example. I've seen that. And anything that eats aphids or scale will probably come along and help with it. Generally speaking, even though you can have a pretty bad outbreak of it, if you do nothing, it'll generally solve itself to some degree. But they're also poorly attached, and it's really fun to wash them off. I strongly recommend that every gardener get a pressure washer as a strategy for dealing with these kinds of pests. And now when I say that, people think, oh my God, that's going to take all the leaves off. You control the throttle, so you don't have to strip the leaves off the plant. But I've found you can get surprisingly close with a pressure washer, the kind of thing you'd clean your car with, and go slowly up and down the branch, and you will blast those cottony cushion scale into oblivion. Next question I always get, well, won't they just crawl back up there? Nope, they can't crawl. So they are now dead, and that will manage it. Did you have a question?
Will that blast take the black mold as well?
Yeah, it depends on how long it's been on there, because that black mold that gets on the surface after a few months kind of just bakes on. But yes, if you get at them now, when the scale are increasing now, the crawler stage, the younger stage is increasing and spreading locally on the branch, more importantly, being picked up by the ants and carried to other places, the mold that you're seeing is fresh. It's just recently grown on that sticky residue. So it will come off pretty readily. If you wait till the end of the summer, it'll be harder to get it off. So this is a really good time, actually, to go out and when you see any kind of scale insect, whether it's the lycanium scale on your apricots, that round one, or the soft brown scale on other plants, or this cottony cushion scale, this is when the crawlers are coming out and spreading. This is when you can get at them before that sticky residue has got so much mold on it that it's hard to get off. You can really clean them up well. And just a pressure washer will do a very good job. Yes, a hose nozzle, you can buy them the kind where you can make a really strong jet nozzle. If you went out and did that once a week for 3 or 4 weeks in a row, you would get very good control. Not only would you be knocking off the big adults, which are the large ones, you'd be blasting off the crawler stage. And of course, you'd be disrupting the trails of ants to some degree as well. If you have a preferred ant control strategy, go ahead and do that, whatever it is. But the main thing is, if you get after the main population right now, you can knock it down substantially. The beneficial insect is present almost everywhere that the scale is present. So oftentimes this problem simply resolves itself. And yes, one other that mentioned in the question, pruning it out is very practical, because they tend to be all in one place. The ants brought them in, they multiplied in that one part of the pittosporum plant. Yes, pruning it out, taking that out, just putting it out in the trash will make a big difference. So pruning, washing, natural control is typically what we do. If you needed to use a spray, the spray would be an oil, a light oil spray. You'll find them sold as summer oil, or you can look at the dormant oil that you used in the winter, and you'll often see on the label there's a summer rate for that, which is usually about half strength. My only concern with oil, if it's above about 85 degrees and you spray oil on a leaf, it'll tend to burn. That's just an unfortunate, it's cosmetic, but it's pretty ugly. So we generally don't spray anything above 85 degrees. You know, that's the general recommendation, but in particular, oil sprays can be a problem. Neem will not be as effective as a true summer oil like this. I know a lot of people like to move to neem very quickly because it's considered very benign, but it won't be as effective. So if you had to spray, if you felt this was really getting ahead of you and you needed to spray, an oil spray would be relatively low toxicity, obviously, and it would smother a whole lot of ants, which might make you feel better, and it would probably smother the crawler stage. The adult scale, and this is the big adaptive strategy. Any pest we're looking at, we want to go, how is this particular pest outwitting us? The adult scale is armored over. I mean, it's got this waxy coating. You could spray it with malathion, you wouldn't kill it. So don't. But you simply can't get at it with a pesticide. But you can kill the crawler stage, which show up in the month of May. So this would be a time to do that if you were that concerned about it. But if it were me, I'd look for those holes. I would take my pressure washer, and on a hot day, I'd go out there, I'd just blast that whole plant off, and I'd prune out the branches that are worst affected if necessary. And then I'd monitor. And this is so important. Integrated pest management, when you learn the principles of IPM, after you've identified your pest, and good on Google Lens for having managed to correctly identify this one, you monitor the population. Is it increasing or decreasing? And I can tell you, as we've said on the show many times, most pest problems have about a 2 to 6 week life cycle. If there are ants involved, figure it's going to be on the 6 week end. But The reproductive rate of most pests drops dramatically at very high temperatures. Most of them have their own particular seasonal cycle. If you monitor and the population isn't getting worse and you've got those holes in them and the numbers seem to be going down, your problem is probably taking care of itself. And don't forget about those little birds that come in and that go in there and peck them off, because I've seen them completely clean off scale and aphids in the past. So there's all kinds of things that feed on scale, aphids, and other sucking insects. Usually these problems solve themselves, but monitoring is the key, and repetition. You spray it off once, you go out a week later, do it again. That's the key thing. You got to do the follow-up, because you always missed some.
I just wanted to clarify that the only ones that have cotton on them are the final stage, the adult stage.
Yep.
The ones that are younger than that, the various stages that they go through, and I don't know how many there are, but they don't have that bright white thing. It's really hard to find them.
Yeah.
But they're smaller and they're on there. I have only once seen this critter, mm-hmm. and it came in on a rose bush that mm-hmm. I bought. I bought the bush, I brought it home, and a couple weeks later, there were these white cotton things. Yeah. And it took a while to figure out what they were. This was a few years ago. But, you know, it was open. It was just a stem, a couple of stems and a few leaves at the top. And I was able to go in there and just, you know, pick them off.
Yeah. Yeah. They're not going anywhere. But
So to his question about, is it because it's inside a bush? No, even outside in the open air, I had these things.
Yeah. They'll increase more in a crowded, protected area on the plant. And also that makes it harder for beneficials to get in. One of the things we've learned at our nursery, for example, any of these hemipterous pests, as I call them, these are all related. Mealybugs, aphids, scale, whiteflies are all related. If we have a part of our nursery where plants are really crowded and packed in together, you know, one of the low turnover parts of the nursery, every garden center has them. The vine section is usually a great candidate for this, really overgrown. You start to see whiteflies and things build up in there, because it's honestly, I'm assuming that it's just harder for the beneficials to get in and go after them. If we go in, clean them up, trim them, spread them out, wash them all off, problem goes away without using any pesticides. We haven't sprayed any pesticides in our nursery for years, and most nurseries are regularly sprayed with pesticides. But we learned this about these types of pests, is that there's a lot of things that want to feed on them, but if it's really crowded and dense in there, they'll probably multiply faster than those can get in. So a little pruning is fine, but again, washing them off and monitoring to make sure you've got the population under control. They don't do a lot of harm, but that black stuff is not good on the leaves because it inhibits photosynthesis. So yes, cottony cushion scale, and I think you're on the right track. And one thing to do, your pittosporum has them, check any nearby citrus trees, check your rose bushes. If you have lilac vine, the hardenbergia, those are the plants I've really seen them on. Part of it is that hardenbergia and pittosporum can get quite dense and overgrown. And so this problem can develop before you really notice it. Oftentimes, as with this case, people notice the mold on the leaves before they actually notice the pest that's causing it.
Well, so that Google Lens was useful in this case.
Yeah, it often is. Yeah.
It often is, and for identifying things. I have questions about houseplants, Don. Mm-hmm. Do houseplants get a calcium deficiency?
Hard to imagine, especially with our water.
So, you know, I play these games on my iPhone, and they have
show
ads,
a calcium?
And one of them is the most annoying thing I've ever seen. It is an ad where you're supposed to point it at your plant, and it identifies what your plant is, and then it tells you what's wrong with it and to put milk on it. What?
Oh my God.
Okay, so if it doesn't get a calcium deficiency, I can't imagine it's good to put oil in there, and milk has certainly got fats in it. Plants don't use fats, do they?
There is no reason to apply milk to the soil of a plant ever. Okay. It's that simple.
Well, I know, but I'm trying to figure out if there's any possibility that there's some grain of truth in some of these things. I know that applying cayenne pepper, there's no truth at all. Sugar, that won't do anything. I mean, plants make sugar. They don't drink sugar, right?
That's true. Yes. Yes. We've already had I just saw on a YouTube video that this person puts sugar in the ground when she puts her tomatoes in the ground. Well, it's harmless, but I can't imagine there's anything positive or negative on honestly.
It'll encourage your ants.
If it's down in the ground underneath the tomato plant, that probably wouldn't be an issue. But the comment on the YouTube video was, it makes the tomatoes sweeter. No, of course it doesn't.
It doesn't make the tomatoes sweeter.
It probably causes, in my opinion, my answer to the person who asked about it was like, what would it do? Well, it caused a little burst of soil bacterial and microbial activity in that area where the sugar was, and then everything would get back to normal. Mm-hmm. Simple fact, anything you add to the soil will pretty quickly be ameliorated by the microbes in the soil. Yeah. There's places where milk byproducts, because of dairy industry being nearby, are incorporated in nearby farm fields, and they watch the population of microbes explode and the stuff breaks down, and probably some of it's taken up by plants. But this is not something that gardeners need to do. And this is, honestly, all of this information online is getting worse, not better.
I know.
It's getting worse, not better.
It's sounding so authoritative when these people, and it's like, and put Coca-Cola on your plant. And it's like, oh my.
So if you're doing
it, I know that they're lying, because they show a picture of a poor little plant with some brown leaves, and they go, okay, it's as you can. And then you do this, and then and that was on Monday. And on Tuesday, the plant is healthy looking, has green leaves, there's no brown at all.
Wow, it's a miracle.
And then the next day, that plant, it was an Easter cactus, is full of blossoms in full bloom the next day. You know that they're lying.
Well, we wish you knew that they were lying, but it's overwhelming the feed. And so if you're actually Googling something, just add .edu to your Google search. That'll probably take you to an actual legitimate site, or just bookmark sites like ucanr.edu if you're in the West. If you're back East, Cornell or Rutgers or other well-known agricultural universities have their own sites. North Carolina State has one of the best I've ever seen. I use it all the time for plant information, especially for plant toxicity information. So once you've found good, reputable academic sites, stop Googling stuff. Google's getting worse. Facebook is getting worse. So don't mean to dump on the major players in the industry, but you've got to filter through all that stuff.
And don't do an app for garden advice.
So far, if y'all have one out there that you think is good, go ahead and let us know at davisgardenshow@gmail.com. I'm finding them better and better for plant ID, yes, and for pest ID, but for horticultural information, no, it's an overwhelming jumble of nonsense, basically. Okay,
so we have an email message from Wen talking about cockroaches in the garden that came from in the house, or in the, they bought a new place and it had an infestation of cockroaches in the garage, and et cetera. So when I put this up for us to talk about this week, Don said, let me do a little research. So Don's got homework. Yes. We will talk about it. Tune in next week.
The main point I would make is that cockroaches are not harmful in the garden. So if you've got a garden and you've got cockroaches running around out there, they're not doing any harm to your plants. But I want to try and figure out why they're getting such a large number around their house. That would be more of a pest control issue, but nothing to be concerned about with your garden plants.
And which kind of cockroaches? So we'll be back with this topic later. Yep. But for right now, we have another question. This is from Benjamin. And Ben writes, I want to thank you for indulging my knowledge addiction. What?
My knowledge addiction?
Thank you for indulging my knowledge addiction.
Yes, it's a good addiction to have.
Yeah, it is a good one. But recognize that with all addictions, there may be a time when you have to cut me off. I will not be offended. So, Ben, keep sending in your questions.
Yeah, we're fine.
They're fine. Okay, my question this week is, can a mini rose convert to a regular rose? See attached photo. This was a gifted mini rose, 5 to 6 plants in a hexagonal and a hexagon in a pot that I killed 3 or 4 times before just planting it outside in the soil. This spring, it's growing full-size leaves instead of the mini leaves that it used to have. What is this phenomenon? And he has photographs. Thank you for the photographs.
Yes.
So when I read this, I think he said there was more than one plant in
it. They do that, yeah.
And the photo that I'm looking at, most of the leaves are tiny. They're like the size of my thumbnail, really small. Yep. And then there's this big shoot coming up that has full size, huge rose leaves. Now, do you think these are two separate plants?
No, in this case, they're probably not. Miniature roses are usually not grafted, whereas many roses that you buy at garden centers are grafted. So if something looking totally different comes up from your hybrid tea rose bush, it's probably rootstock. Not all roses are grafted. We grow all of our own roses at our nursery from cuttings, but the ones you buy at your conventional sources of big outdoor roses for your garden are grafted. They're two plants. It's like a double delight rose grafted onto a Dr. Huey rootstock. If a big vigorous shoot comes up and it has semi-double red flowers, and by the way, they're blooming all over right now, it's a pretty enough plant, but it's not what you purchase. But the miniature roses in the industry are cutting grown. And for whatever reason, they cram like three cuttings into a 4-inch pot. I've watched this. These are very cool plants in general. If you go to Trader Joe's or Safeway or places like that, that's where people are finding these. And I love to look at the displays. They're miniature only in the sense of having miniature flowers, but the greenhouse production process, they can pinch them and also treat them with plant growth regulators, which keep them compact. And this is true of many of the bedding plants that you buy. There's about 10 or 11 different plant growth regulator sprays that are used in the forest end of the nursery industry, I guess we could call it. And they'll treat them with these to keep them tight and compact and bloom abundantly. And that eventually wears off. And so my guess is that's what you're seeing here without knowing the particular variety, how big it's supposed to get, or, you know, where it came from. That's my best guess, because most of these miniature roses are cutting grown. They do crowd them in the pot for a really full effect. They probably do one treatment with a PGR, plant growth regulator, during the early growth cycle of the plant. And it makes these really cool little plants that are in full bloom at about 6-8 inches tall. They're perfectly good garden plants. This is an important thing to know. You buy this or someone gives it to you, they're not house plants. Roses do not grow indoors. Roses will get spider mites. They won't bloom well. They don't have enough light, and they're really hard to keep in a small pot. So enjoy the blooms for a few weeks. And at that point, move them up into a bigger container or put them out in the garden. Most of them that I've looked at, I've tried to look up some of these varieties. There are probably 500 miniature rose cultivars out there. Most of them turn into shrubs 2 to 4 feet. Some of them get bigger than that. The flowers stay small, so that's why they're used for these programs. And they often look like absolutely perfect little miniature roses. And they're generally very good garden plants. They're actually pretty disease resistant, and they make a nice little shrub out in the garden. This one appears to be outgrowing the plant growth regulator, probably will turn into a 3 to 4 foot bush. We'll have a whole lot of small flowers on it, but it won't be miniature as it was when he purchased it. That's my best guess. I know about greenhouse production practices. Plant growth regulators are very common in the nursery industry for certain types of plants. They shorten the internode distances. They induce basal branching. And they keep the plant more compact, and they have to be used very carefully, but they're very widely used. A fact that most people don't know.
So I just want to clarify, you said that these little miniature plants, when you buy them at the store, mm-hmm. sometimes already are blooming. And the flowers are very small. They're like an inch, aren't they, about?
Yeah, 1 to 2 inches typically. Okay. Yeah.
And so when this big shoot comes up and it grows into a 4-foot bush, mm-hmm. is it also going to have tiny flowers that are 1 to 2 inches?
Yes, the flower size remains the same, but the plant size does not.
Okay.
Also, when you get these plants where there's like 3 or 4 together in a pot, people say, well, shouldn't I separate them? You can if you wish, although that may be a little hard on the plant at first. Yes, you've got probably 3 or 4 plants in there, as was noted in this note. You can split them apart. It wouldn't hurt to plant them all together, and that's what a lot of people do. The best use for these miniature roses when you're given them as a gift is to move them right away to a larger container or put them out in the ground. In any place that roses grow well, miniature roses will grow well. It's actually a really cool group of plants. And just treat them like a little shrub. You prune them. Now, here's the question I always get. How do you prune them? Well, if you try to follow old rules on these miniature roses, like pretend they're a hybrid tea or something, that isn't going to work because they don't have canes. They don't follow the book. So what I did when I grew a lot of miniature roses was about every other year, I'd cut them back really, really hard. I would just take them down to about 4 to 6 inches because they get really twiggy. There's a lot of crowded stuff on the interior. And so if they get something like downy mildew, it tends to spread really rapidly. So I just found, alternate years is cut them back real hard and let them resprout, and they come back right away. You can prune them almost any way you want to. These miniature roses are fun. It's a great way to get going with an interest in roses and gardening if you don't have a lot of space. But even the miniatures in a container, should probably be about at least a 16 to 18 inch diameter container. The minimum I would use is a 5 gallon nursery bucket, and really you'll be better off with something even wider than that. They do need a fair bit of soil. They're not miniature root systems. They don't stay miniature. They just work really well for this particular, what I call the florist end of the nursery industry.
If one has one of these miniature roses that they got as a gift, mm-hmm. and they'd like to keep it as a miniature rose, are the home gardeners able to buy this hormone to keep them stunted?
No, not easily. Just prune them. Yeah.
All right.
By the way, some stay small. There's micro minis. I mean, I grew a lot of miniature roses back in the 1990s, and there was one I grew. I can't remember the name of it. It only got 6 inches. It was really cute. So Ralph Moore bred miniature roses. He created that whole category of roses. Rather amazing man, UC Davis graduate. And he produced hundreds of varieties, and some of them were climbers. Some of them were 3 foot and 4 foot shrubs. Some of them were, the micro minis only got a foot tall. So if you really get into it, you can go out and find, particularly maybe working with your local rose group, some of the really cool ones that are good garden plants that stay smaller. But in general, we used to say when these were a big deal, the 90s and for about a decade after that, miniature roses are really hot. I would say the only miniature part that I can guarantee is miniature is the flower. The plant may or may not stay miniature. It really depends. So
if you got one of those micro mini roses and it's only a foot tall,
yeah.
Is the root system going to be small?
No, or? They're vigorous roots. That's the important
thing. The roots are big, even though the top is little.
The roots are vigorous, yeah. So like any roses are big shrubs. Even the miniatures have pretty substantial root systems.
All right. Well, let's move on. And I wanted to ask you, you know, these are the generic kind of questions that we ask every week. And you tell me a little bit about it, but you don't have to go into details. Mm-hmm. So I know you plant seeds. What mm-hmm. seeds are you starting right now?
Right now, me? Oh, let me turn to my little tray here of the seeds I'm going to start today. Chef's Choice Orange Tomatoes, a giant flowered marigold that I got from Park Seed Company. Huge flowered celosia. I'll be planting a shorter celosia and basil. I'm starting all of those today in my home greenhouse. At our nursery, we are starting lots of basil because it's now warm enough for basil and it grows very quickly in our greenhouse. We are starting seeds of squash, cucumbers. A week or so, we'll start doing some seeds of melons. We're continuing to plant tomatoes because there's varieties we sell that we can't get from our growers. So we're continuing to start those and we'll have those out. And let's see, what else are we planting out there? I'm particularly big on zinnias this year because I think everybody in the Sacramento Valley should plant zinnias. They do great here. They love the sun. They like the heat. They like dry conditions. And there's as fun as sunflowers and give you more bloom for the buck.
I think everyone should plant nasturtiums.
If you have more shade, Lois does, nasturtiums are great. Yeah, walking through this elementary school to go give these talks, it was really interesting. There are gardens all over elementary schools in Davis now. There's active garden programs, and Willett Elementary, where I was, has a really good garden program. Spectacular planting of nasturtiums on the way in. Schools tend to have a really weird mix of sun and shade. You know, it's really challenging for the gardener. There'll be tables over here, and that'll be sunny, and this will be shady. Someone had the presence of mind to fill a planter that was in bright shade near one of the tables where the kids like to gather with nasturtiums, and they were in full bloom, looking great. So it's one of the really easy plants to grow. I know we have one listener out there who's almost entirely shade gardener. Gaina, plant some nasturtiums, okay?
And nasturtiums have big seeds that the kids can handle really well. Yeah. You can plant those anytime, can't you? I mean, you don't have
actually,
to.
Yes, nasturtiums are a plant that are happiest in our spring and fall weather conditions, but they're okay in the summer if they're in the shade, and they usually make it through the winter. So you can practically plant them anytime here in the valley. Those of you in the coastal zones, you're probably going, nasturtium, those run all over my yard. Yeah, they do in mild climates. So be cautious where you plant them. But you know, if you're doing a project with kids or you just want something super easy to grow, we did a seed planting at this elementary school and I used sunflowers, zinnias, and zucchini. By the way, there's about a 2-to-1 preference for sunflowers. That's good. They're easy to plant. They come up quickly, but you do need a sunny spot for them. And I kept thinking there's probably some of these kids who don't have a sunny garden location. Nasturtiums are a great choice for that. Yes, easy to hold, manipulate, stick in the little pot, and they come up very quickly. And even if you don't have enough light for them to bloom, the foliage is cool. So they're actually a fun plant to grow. And here's another thing about nasturtiums. Not only do they not get pests typically, they seem to repel pests. So I've observed for example, that the white butterfly that goes out and oviposits on our broccoli and cauliflower and things like that in the fall.
Cabbage moth.
Yes. If there's nasturtiums nearby, they'll go and oviposit on that. And then the eggs will hatch and the little larva will start to feed and die. So you've drawn them away from your brassicas onto your nasturtiums as a trap crop. Little sinister thing there. I didn't tell the kids about that.
Well, the kids would have loved it.
They would love, yes.
Yeah. So, so you're planting seeds now. What are you harvesting now? Anything?
Oh, there's still some really good citrus coming in. Right now, tango mandarins are at their peak of sweetness. Their acidity is dropping a little bit. Tango is a mid-season mandarin. It's one of the ones in the Cuties program. And it's one of the best. It's a very vigorous plant, very productive. So if you're looking for a single seedless mandarin for your backyard, Tango is a very, very good one. Gold Nugget will be next, but Tango's ripening right now. Still some blood oranges hanging on the tree out there. Valencia orange is still hanging on the tree. Berries will be coming up shortly. Berries ripen in the month of May. So we're at a in-between season. Citrus is still being picked, and some varieties go all the way into the late spring, early summer. Or just a few weeks away from the deciduous fruits, as we call them, the berries, and then, of course, the very first peaches and things like that.
I'll ask you again in another week or two.
Yep.
Okay, so I don't want to have a downer, but what sort of problems should people be looking for? What should they expect?
Right now, we're seeing a lot of fire blight because of the weather we've had for the last about 10 days. Has been perfect fire blight weather. So I'm getting a lot of pictures of pear trees, many times the ornamental pears, the Bradford pear relatives, but also fruiting pears are getting fire blight very badly. And it's showing up on pyracanthas and here and there on apples and so forth. So we're still in fire blight season. We don't want to go into a full how to control it. We're just telling you what to look for.
And I know that there's a little scale because we just talked about that cottony cushion scale. And I'm sure that the other scale insects and aphids are there, but the eaters are also there.
Yeah, the aphids first showed up 2 to 3 weeks ago, and immediately the lacewings and the leatherwing beetles and the ladybird beetles and so forth showed up. One listener, actually a customer, sent me a picture of something crawling all over his plants and wanted to know what it was. And I looked at the picture and I thought, this looks like a ladybug larva, but it's smaller and faster moving. It turns out in his case, it's the Asian ladybird beetle, Asian ladybug, which has become a real nuisance back east. We have them here, but our native ladybugs seem to outcompete them. However, they were moving fast, and at least they were eating aphids. That's on the plus side. We've had a lot of problems with earwigs, which is normal as we get into late April and into May. That's an easy one to monitor. Although I made a mistake. The first sample that came in, I thought, this looks like snail damage. I mean, this is just eaten to pieces here. And I said, go out at night. Everybody get a flashlight, head out in your garden at night and see what's going on out there. Some people think that's great. Other people think it's a little dubious. She went out, the shoot of citrus that had been eaten was covered with earwigs. So that was the problem. It wasn't that any single one was the problem. It was the sheer numbers of them. I said, well, that's a good opportunity because you can just kill them right there. Monitoring for earwigs is easy. If you don't happen to want to go out with a flashlight, take a bowl, put some aromatic oil in it, put it, you know, just a film like a quarter inch, put it on the ground underneath the plant, check it in the morning. Pretty good chance if that's your problem, you'll find a number of earwigs in there dead in the oil. So earwigs are out and they tend to be the month of May.
So for those of you who are a little squeamish and don't really want to take a flashlight out and do this, here's a thought. Take your phone, turn on your flashlight app, get it all set up with the photos, and then go out, look at the plant, push the button for the take a photo and walk away. And then you can look at the photo.
You can just walk up and look at the bugs. So
this way you have proof of what they are. Yeah. And if you don't recognize them, you can send them in to davisgardenshow@gmail.com and say, what's this thing?
Or try Google Lens, see what kind of answer it gives you. You can, by the way, kill an earwig pretty easily. You can just squish it. But I suggest wearing gloves when you do that. Earwigs have a particular season. The other thing I want to mention, because I've had several people walk in with them, all three major rose diseases are present on rose bushes right now because of the weather we've been having. We started with downy mildew that's causing a lot of leaf drop. We have had powdery mildew, which gets on the new growth, but just causes a white powder on the leaves. And rust, if your plant was near a lawn or you have sprinklers or just had a bad case of rust, we got enough rain last Saturday to make diseases worse, but not to really hydrate the soil. I'll do a quick one on this one. If it's bad downy mildew and lots of leaves are falling off, if it's really bad rust, prune it back again. pretend it's January, cut it back, take all that stuff, get rid of it. As it pushes out, we'll be going into dry weather. The problem will basically solve itself. So the three major diseases on roses, there's no fungicide, in my opinion, out there that works. And why would you do that? But you can just prune them back and deal with it that way. Powdery mildew, the white powder on the leaves, you can actually wash that off, believe it or not. I mean, if the plant gets it chronically, then maybe take that plant out. But a little bit of powdery mildew here and there and some aphids, well, that rinsing method actually does take off powdery mildew. It makes rust and downy mildew worse, but it takes care of powdery mildew. So you can use your judgment, but bear in mind, we're also going to warm up and dry out. And in our climate, these problems go away, which is another issue. It's drying out there. Last evening when I came home and walked into my backyard, there was my very friendly feral cat curled up in my chair. And 10 feet away, it was a fox curled up on the ground in the sun. Why? Because I have a water bowl in the backyard for them. And apparently that's their water source now. So the naturally occurring water sources out in the field are drying up and the wildlife are moving in. This tells us two things. If you like to encourage birds and others, this is a great opportunity now to put out some kind of really simple source of water. It also tells us that the ground is drying out and it doesn't feel like that because we've been unusually cool for about the last 2 weeks. Guy came in with drooping new growth on a Chinese pistache, and he thought it might be a disease. Fortunately, in his case, it wasn't. It's a relatively young tree, been in for 1 year, maybe its second year. The new flush of tender growth is coming out, and his soil had just dried out enough for it to start wilting, start drooping. So it was just a chance to say, okay, this is how I want you to water this tree. Give it 10 to 15 gallons of water once a week, nice basin around it, or set your timer to give it a good thorough soaking once a week, something like that. But the soil is beginning to dry out. And normally by the first part of May, we would be understanding that because we'd be in the 80s. And we'd be feeling warm and dry in the afternoon, so we would understand that plants are drying out. After a week of cloudy weather, it was kind of hard for people to realize that they actually need to water. So yes, your sprinkler system should be on. Yes, you should be watering young trees. I'm involved in Tree Davis. Our crew is out now, you know, once a week watering on trees we just planted last year, every 2 weeks on trees a year that have been in for a full year, once a month for trees in their third year, giving them 10 to 20 gallons of water each time we go by with a tank truck. And we're doing 1,000 trees around the Davis area, watering them through the summer that way to make sure they get off to a good start. You can do that too. You don't have to have a sprinkler system to get a new tree established. Just give it a good soaking once a week, every 2 weeks, once a month, depending on what it is, where it is, and how long it's been in the ground.
So the next thing is a question. What to do about weeds now? I know that you keep talking about, well, take care of them in January and all that stuff. But now, so here's my response to that question. Pull them. If it's grass, just pull them up. They come out easy. Yeah. Cut them. Rake the stuff out of there and then put a note on your calendar to remove them next winter.
Yeah, most of the weeds you're dealing with now came up with the rains in October, November, December. That really annoying one, cleavers or bed straw, can germinate as late as February, and it can germinate at colder temperatures than other weeds, so it can continue sprouting right through the winter. That's probably the one I'm talking to people the most about. That and foxtails are the two that they're most concerned about. Foxtails, obviously, because of the threat to pets, and the other one just because it seems like it came out of nowhere and it engulfs things, and you get the seed things all over you. It's an extremely annoying one, and it can be irritating to the skin. Really, when a weed is going into its reproductive phase, just get the reproductive phase out of there. I mean, mow them, rake them, get rid of the seeds if you possibly can. That's really all you're able to do right now. There's nothing, I can't think how to explain this better than it's at the end of its life cycle. So there's nothing to prevent it, and there's nothing that'll prevent it next year at this stage. You just get as much of that out there as you possibly can. I had someone come in who has just recently moved into a neighborhood, and the whole front, which is accessible to the public, was in foxtails. You know, it's grassy foxtails, and the neighbors came over and they were concerned about it. Great, let's have a mowing party. What are you going to do about it? Well, there's nothing to do about them now except mow them and rake them up. Okay, there's nothing that will kill them. It's not even worth spraying with an herbicide. Mow them down, rake them up, bag that up, get rid of it if you possibly can. Those came up in October, November. At that time, whatever you're willing to do, whether it's an herbicide or a mulch or whatever, you can get really good control. Even if it's a small area, you can hoe out seedlings at that stage before the soil gets too muddy. You can get a delivery of arborist wood chips, and you can bury everything in 4 to 6 inches of wood chips. That'll smother the weeds that are down there. Of course, new ones will land in the wood chips and root, but those will be really easy to pull out. That'll be a much more manageable thing. So you have to have a long-term strategy. Right now, April, May, you just cut down, mow, rake up, throw away. That's pretty much it for the weeds that we're dealing with that came up with the winter rains and grew through the spring. Most of those things have been up there for 3 months or so before they really took off, especially that cleavers or bed straw.
Velcro plant. Hearing it called now.
I've been meaning to find my old pictures I took in the winter of the seedlings, which are cute. They come up, they're like 2 inches high for a month. They creep along the ground. They look like a ground cover. It's January, they're barely doing anything. Anytime in that period, whatever weed management strategy you're willing to do would have been very effective, very easy. Burying it, hoeing it, spraying it, any of a number of things. Even pretty vulnerable to those top kill type herbicides that people like to buy, you know, the soap based ones or the vinegar ones, that kind of thing. It's even pretty vulnerable to that. But in general, that stage, they're easy. And then the days start getting longer. Starts to warm up in February, it goes into flowering mode. You can still get good control in February with a hoe or with a flamer, you know, propane torch, whatever you want to use. Even again, still burying it in mulch, such as arborist wood chips, will work at that stage. By March, it's gone into the rambunctious phase, which is the climbing up onto things, running under things, climbing up the fence, flowering, and now it has the seeds that are sticking to everything and are maturing. So get it all out of there now. As Lois says, mark your calendar for next year in, let's say, November and February. Those would be two key weed management strategy times for the winter sprouting and growing annual weeds that you're dealing with now. We'll have our next crop of weeds coming up shortly. Those are the summer ones. That's a different conversation. But if you're dealing with foxtails, or bed straw in particular, physically remove it as best you can. And the good news is this doesn't require a lot of horticultural skill. You can just hire someone to do it. You can get kids to do it, whatever. Just be aware the seeds of that bed straw are going to get all over them and their socks and their pants and whatever. So before they leave the site, they need to brush them all off, get rid of them, so they aren't tracking it to another house. But other than that, it's just physical removal at this stage. Right now, the foxtails in particular, which are very, very injurious to pets, are getting ready to dry off. So if you can possibly mow those down with a mower or a weed eater, let them dry for a couple of days, rake them up, dispose of them, that'll reduce the risk to pets. Those all came up again late fall and into the winter, so that was the time to take action against them. There's a lot of ways you can deal with weed seedlings. Dealing with mature weeds with ripening seeds is just physical removal, unfortunately.
Okay, so we have one more thing which is going to lead into another thing which leads into a third thing.
Okay.
And the one said last Sunday you had two cases of lace bug.
Yeah.
Now, being very clear, lace bug is not lace wing.
Correct. Lace bug is an insect that attacks, unfortunately, one of our California native shrubs, as well as some of its related plants. Lace bug is attacks Toyon. And it's one of the only things that really goes wrong with Toyon here. We don't get a lot of problems, but this is a California native shrub that isn't really native here in the valley, but pretty close over there in the oak woodland plant community, just uphill in the Coast Range. And they do very well. It seems to be quite resistant to crown rot compared to others. And I even found it on a list of plants that is supposedly resistant to crown rot. So it's certainly been my observation that of the native woody plants for the valley, it's one of the best. Seems to grow in a wide range of conditions. But twice in the same day, I think it was, people walked in with a leaf that was looking sort of scurfy on top, highly technical term there, rough, discolored on top, as if it had spider mites. If you've ever seen a spider mite infestation, you know how they get that kind of dusty and as I say, a scurfy appearance. Flip it over, there were these things that looked like globs of resin, little things that looked dark and stuck on there real hard. Well, that's their excretion. And the lace bug itself generally isn't still present on the sample by the time it gets to my garden center, unless you put it in a bag or a jar. They're very attractive and interesting. So here's the thing about having grown up with a biologist for a mother. A pest problem was first an educational opportunity. And we had to look at the thing and look at it with a hand lens and get out the field guide to insects and figure out what it was, then we could decide if we were going to kill it. But she was very curious about the insect itself. Well, I can tell you, lace bugs are really interesting. They're sort of, the body is the size of an aphid, but they have these lovely, elaborate wings, lacy wings, hence the name lace bug. Lace wing is a really cool beneficial insect with those gossamer green wings that you'll see around your porch light. And well, they are primarily feeding on nectar and things. Their larvae are very aggressive aphid eaters. Their larvae look like little antlion type things. They're that kind of dragon-like insect. That's a lace bug, excuse me, a lace wing. We want them. Lace bugs.
And they will eat lace bugs.
Probably. Yeah, I'd have to.
Well,
have
I have
to
a check picture them. Here.
Oh, do you? Okay, good. Okay.
I've got the IPM website up, and it's talking all about lace bugs, giving me lots of information, including a picture that says a green lace wing larva eating a lace bug nymph.
Yeah, it's basically
kind
an
of
aphid.
Gross,
so anything that feeds on the other aphids and their relatives will probably feed on these. I've never seen them get so bad that they harm the plant, but they can really make a cosmetic difference on the foliage. And as with anything in that group, much like aphids, you can blast them off. It seems that resiny stuff doesn't come off very readily. But if you've got that open in front of you, what is the website you're looking at?
ucanr.edu.
Right.
And then you'll have to just search for lace bug.
Lace bug, not lace wing necessarily. But they're going to manage them. If you had to spray, an oil spray would smother them. You'd have to get it on the undersides of the leaves. Of course, that would
But it isn't going to do anything to the poop.
No, that'll still be there. The thing you'd be trying to do is stop the population from increasing. Well, of course, if you spray with anything, including oil, you'll also be smothering the beneficial things like the lace wings that are coming in and feeding on them, at least their larvae. So you have to make that trade-off. It vigorously rinsing the plant is helpful anyway. Just a reminder, we like to do this during the summer here in the Sacramento Valley, interior Southern California, East Bay, dry parts of California. Going out and washing plants off is a really important integral part of pest management. And so if these are becoming a problem on your Toyon or your Photinia, which is closely related to Toyon, then you may wish to take that valve and put it on your hose and vigorously rinse off, which is going to be our answer to just about every pest problem during the course of the summer. It's a really simple way to manage it. Again, I've not seen this problem get so severe that it really compromises the health of the plant. It's just more of an appearance thing. And they do have a limited temperature range for reproduction, so it tends to outgrow it. So I would only take action if it's really, as I say, compromising the health or significantly impacting the appearance. And if you can just tolerate it and rinse the plant off, that'll probably be all you need to do. But lace bug is a sort of unfortunate insect that does hit one of our native plants.
Well, we usually close our show with a quote. So today my quote is, viewed properly, anything can be a plaything. Oh, wait a minute. That was the kitten quote. let me do the other one. looked at the right way, the whole world is a garden.
I like them both. I think I'll make both of those. You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore.
And Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.
Hi, folks. This is Don Shore. Lois Richter and I produce the Davis Garden Show every week for your listening pleasure. Lois does a public affairs show called That's Life, and I produce Jazz After Dark. Those are just three of the many locally produced radio programs, all created by volunteers here in Davis, broadcasting on this little tiny radio station, KDRT at 95.7 FM. KDRT is a project of Davis Media Access, a local nonprofit organization dedicated to providing civic information, fostering community, and providing entertainment outside the boundaries of commercial radio. If you like what you hear, we'd appreciate it if you join us on the big day of giving today with your contribution. It's a 24-hour giving celebration from the Sacramento Region Community Foundation, rallying people to support causes they love in El Dorado, Placer, Sacramento, and Yolo counties. If you listen outside the area, we'd love to have you join in as well. Just visit davismedia.org/bigdog. And make your donation. That's davismedia.org/bigdog. Thanks to your donations, past and future. And as always, thanks for listening to KDRT.